two floors above my head here in the studio at NPR. On the fourth floor, there's a quiet room that's informally known as the nap room. It's a place where worn-out journalists catch up on a few minutes of sleep when they need it. Well, according to a recent study, those short naps may help your brain work better. Matthew Walker led that study. He researches sleep at the University of California, Berkeley. Matthew Walker, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, it's not exactly breaking news that getting, you know, sleep now and then helps you function. So what's the question you were trying to answer with this study?
Well, despite us all knowing the sort of subjective benefits of sleep, what may be surprising to the general public is that scientists and doctors do not still have a satisfying answer as to why we sleep. And that's, of course, one-third of our lives. And what has been probably known for some time is that sleep after learning is critical to sort of cement those new memories into the neural architecture of the brain. But what we've understood less is whether sleep before learning is equally important in sort of preparing your brain almost like a dry sponge, ready to soak up new information the next day. And that was really what we were focusing on here.
So tell me how you tested this question.
So we took two groups of healthy young adults, and both of them performed two separate learning sessions. But the thing that differentiated the two groups was that after the first learning session, but before the second learning session, one half of those participants actually had a 90-minute sleep opportunity, a 90-minute nap in the middle of the afternoon, whilst the other group remained awake.
So what did you find?
So what we found was that across the day, those people who remained awake got about 10% worse in their ability to learn, whilst those who had a nap improved by about 10%. Hmm. So at the end of the day, there's a difference of about 20% between those two.
Hmm. Well, what does it tell us about what's happening in our brains when we sleep?
What we believe happens is that when we initially learn information, that information is bound and sort of collected together by one specific part of the brain, a region that we call the hippocampus. But what we also believe is that that area is almost the sort of the short-term reservoir for that newly learned memory. And for that memory to persist and survive, it has to pass into a more long-term storage location in the brain. And that's in an area that we call the cortex, which is this folded mass of tissue on the top of your brain. And what we've hypothesized is that perhaps during sleep and particular stages of sleep, that information is actually shifted from one location, the hippocampus, to another, the cortex. So there's a dual benefit, perhaps a shifting of memory, a change in the geography of information at night that allows you to efficiently learn the next day.
What do you think the practical applications of this ought to be? I mean, should high schools or, you know, offices schedule nap time during the day?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. At some point, we as adults just stop ourselves sort of thinking that there's a benefit of sleep. And instead, which is even worse, we start to associate sufficient sleep with laziness. Now, think about that in the context of children. You would never look at a child who is sleeping sufficient amounts and think, well, what a lazy infant. And so it's a funny paradox that we find ourselves in as adults, where we seem to think sleep is perhaps more of a luxury that we can choose or choose not to engage in, instead of realizing that, in fact, as we're understanding more through science, that it's a biological necessity.
Matthew Walker is a psychology professor and a sleep researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. And Matthew Walker, I'm going to go take a nap right now.
Sounds good. Sleep well.
With St. Patrick's Day just ahead, we have an unusual musical mashup for you today. Paddy Maloney and his legendary Irish group, The Chieftains, have joined Ry Cooder and artists from south of the American border. They tell a musical story on their new CD called San Patricio, Spanish for St. Patrick. The recording comes out Tuesday and commemorates a little-known connection between Mexico and Ireland. During the Mexican-American War of the 1840s, a group of disaffected Irish-American conscripts led by Captain John Riley crossed the border to fight with the Mexicans. Here to tell us about that and the project are Ry Cooder, who joins us from NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And Paddy Maloney, who joins us from Vox Now Studios in Naples, Florida. Hi, Paddy.
How are you? Delighted to be here and talking, chatting with you all.
Well, I'm delighted to have you, and I'm going to start with you because I want you to tell us the story of the Irish and their role in the Mexican-American War.
The story itself is just fascinating, and when I saw the name John Riley, a man from Connemara in the west of Ireland, when he was enlisted against his wishes, I would believe, he was given a rifle to go down there and shoot Mexicans, and that didn't go down too well at all. One reason, of course, they were Catholics, but also the injustice that was taking place. And he was very familiar with what was happening back in Ireland for many hundreds of years. So he put together this great battalion, the San Patricio. They deserted the American army, went to fight with the Mexicans. And they fought five very heroic, wonderful battles. And I'm afraid the last one was at Churubusco, which... Was the finisher upper, as they say.
We are the San Patricios, a brave and gallant band. There'll be no white flag flying within this green command. We are the San Patricios. We have but one demand: to see the Yankees safely home across the Rio Grande.
You have Liam Neeson narrating a poem in tribute to the San Patricios on the CD, and there are a lot of other artists who are participating. Linda Ronstadt, Los Tigres del Norte, Lila Downs. Rye Cooter, let me ask you, what surprised you about the connections between Mexican and Irish music? Did you make some discoveries here?
Well, these Irish soldiers and then civilians, Mexican civilians, would have known their country songs and their Irish dances and things and melodies. And I imagine that they found that they joined like joinery, like wood joinery, you know, together with what the Mexican folks like to dance to as well. And very, very compatible, you know. So, as a musician, I have to say, when you start to hear these things and the tunes interlocking, at this point in my life, I'm not so surprised anymore. But but it is, as Patty's saying, it's a great story and one that certainly is going to, I think, is going to interest people. I was never taught this in Los Angeles public schools, I'm going to tell you. By the way, I want to add, my own great-grandfather, my never-knew Jack O'Leary, was one of these conscripted Irish guys who was a farmer, stepped off the boat in the Ellis Island there. This is the family story, and as soon as he got down the gangplank, there were two officers, army officers, waiting for him. Here's your uniform, and here's your gun.
Wow. Patty Maloney, how about for you? Were there some surprising musical connections that you found doing this project?
Yes, as you know, I started it about, a year and a half ago, and right from the word go, Lila Downs came into the studio in New York, and the fusion that started there sort of totally inspired me, like there was two harps going one against one another. And it was like a little battle of the harps, you know, and this was something I didn't have planned, but, you know, I slotted in 16 bars of it there and gave them the go-ahead, you know, to do what they wanted. And then at the end of the whole day, you know, Lila was up doing her little dance routine to the songs, to the iguana, and I had my Irish dancers, it just happened to be there, and they joined in, and so there was a big hooli, as we call it back in Ireland, like a big party, and maybe a little drop of tequila thrown in for good measure.
There's one song you write on this, Rye, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's quite right.
Yep. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, I like the idea of the soldiers writing home. Everybody is interested in this. The last words, perhaps, the last communication, the last thought, you know, to the loved ones at home. And what's his last thoughts going to be?
Take a message to my Mary. She's the one that's true, I know. When you saw me, I had fallen on the sands of Mexico.
They never had seen this kind of climate, never had 4-day dust storms that caused them to get lost from their regiment, or their pack mules ran off with the food. I mean, they had the terrible time down there. 120 degrees, 110 degrees out there with a full pack, wool uniforms. Can you imagine? No water. What's he thinking of? This is what it seems to me to be about. So that's how, you know, it's...
You did a great job, Roy. Terrific. A great song.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Talking about some of the artists that you have on this project, one of the most distinctive voices on this CD is Chavela Vargas. And it's interesting because she was picked as one of NPR's 50 Great Voices series. But tell us a little bit about her.
Well, when I went down to Mexico last year, she was rather ill at the time, and she couldn't come up for the recording, so I was kicking myself. I did get some other great other artists, but she very unfortunately wasn't too well, and I thought I'd lost her. And because she's into her 90s now, and she's young, 90 lady, but she got in touch about 6 months later, and she said, I'm back in form, and she sent me four wonderful songs. And I picked this particular one.
Y siento tus amarras arrastrar en mi noche callada, que sea plenilunada, azul como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna.
Patty, was this kind of an impetus for you? I mean, you really want us to learn a little bit about this history? I mean, and what kind of impression do you want to leave on us after we hear this?
Well, you know, without getting in there and pointing fingers and blaming this one, this is a part of history that happened. I mean, it's not right that such an event took place, and it's not in the history books. I mean, nobody knows about it over here, and very few people know about it back home. I will say that the Mexican government and the Irish government, they did release two postage stamps to commemorate. That was in 1997. One came out in Ireland, one came out in Mexico, and just to commemorate the San Patricio. And I think that was, you know, at least something being said at long last. And so I think the story, it's a great piece of material for people to know about.
San Patricio is the new CD coming out Tuesday by The Chieftains, featuring Ry Cooter. Ry Cooter joined us from NPR West. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patty Maloney from The Chieftains joined us from Vox Now Studios in Naples, Florida. Thank you very much, and happy San Patricio Day.
Oh, thank you. Gramina mahagat.
Gracias. You can hear San Patricio in its entirety on our website, nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. If you find yourself in the Richmond Hill neighborhood of Queens, New York, and happen to see a pet store that looks straight out of 1965, take a moment to duck inside. Among the wood paneling and the powerful smell of bird feed, you'll find what some say may be the oldest living fish in New York City. Vanessa Romo has a story.
There's the adage about New York that if you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere. Well, if that's true, there's a fish in Queens whose name ought to be up in lights. And that name is...
Butkus.
As in the football player Dick Butkus.
Because he was so big. That's how he got his name.
Steve Grubel owns the Cameo Pet Shop and has been working there for 46 years. And for all but three, he's had Butkus by his side.
I got him in 1967. I sold him in 1968. And I got him back at the end of 1970. When I came home from Vietnam.
So, not only is he huge, Butkus weighs in at about 15 pounds and is 22 inches long. He's also really old. As far as black pacus go, this fish is ancient. Already he's lived more than twice what the species normally do.
According to the books, they only live 20 years, and he's 43 that I know of.
I know I stand in line until you...
To put it in perspective, this was the number one song in America the week Butkus was taking his first strokes.
And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me.
The world has changed in myriad remarkable ways since then. There was the moon landing, the fall of the Soviet Empire, Lady Gaga. Meanwhile, for Butkus, a silent underwater survivor of this great history, the view hasn't really changed. He's been living in the same 4-foot-long, 75-gallon tank for most of his life.
I did have a few people that were a little upset that he was in such a small tank, but he's been in there for 40 years. So if I change his environment now, he might not survive it. So
the black pacu is related to the piranha and seems to have hit every ugly branch on the family tree. It's a homely fish with pointy teeth, and Butkus in particular has some problems. Over the years, his gills have become deformed, he's grown a hunchback, and he's developed glaucoma in his right eye, which, considering it decreases the chances of catching his reflection in the tank, might actually be a blessing. But ever a proud papa, Grubel brags.
Well, you know what it is? He's my barometer. People walk in the store and they look at the fish and they go, holy crap, look at the size of that fish. People love him.
One of the people who loves him is 84-year-old Pat Polishano, a spry World War II veteran who's not quite 5 feet tall.
But cute. That's what the ladies in the senior center tell me. But now you have to understand what they all look like.
Polishano is Grubel's longtime friend. He, too, has been a fixture at the shop for 40 years and comes in around the same time every day just to chew the fat. His favorite thing about Butkus? To watch him eat.
I have watched him consume thousands of goldfish because I make it a point to remind him every time I come in, feed the beast.
It is a spectacle when Butkus is fed. Like any trained pet, he knows the routine.
Watch Butkus's reaction.
As soon as he sees Grubel walking down the aisle toward the tank, Butkus jams his face into the corner of the glass and starts swinging his tail back and forth like a dog. Grubel pours 20 unsuspecting goldfish into the tank, and a small crowd gathers around for the show.
There he goes.
Butkus uses his mouth like a Dyson vacuum cleaner. He creates so much suction that he brings fish several inches away into his mouth. Within minutes, he slurped up and devoured 16 fish.
Well, now he's going to get them. He got three of them there.
This is the most excitement there's been in the store for weeks, says Grubel, which should tell you just how slow business has been. But however tight things get, one item in Cameo Pet Shop is strictly not for sale. So if somebody walked in here and wanted to buy him...
I wouldn't sell him. He's a member of the family now.
And this aquatic family member has another birthday coming up. On April 1st, Butkus turns 44 years young. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo.
I love you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
You know those annoying forwarded emails you get from your mom or a slightly unhinged relative? The ones with the stupid jokes or conspiracy theories? Well, most of them probably end up in your trash bin, but every once in a while, something comes through that's practically gold. And one of those golden moments came in the late 1990s. It was from an essay in the Chicago Tribune, an imagined commencement address to graduating seniors that was mistakenly attributed to writer Kurt Vonnegut. That essay was so powerful, it was emailed around the globe. And when Australian filmmaker Baz Luhrmann read it, he decided to set it to music. He called the song Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen.
Live in New York City once, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in Northern California once, but leave before it makes you soft. Travel. Accept certain inalienable truths. prices will rise, politicians will philander, you too will get old. And when you do, you'll fantasize that when you were young, prices were reasonable, politicians were noble, and children respected their elders.
Another kind of essay in that genre has been making the email rounds lately. This one, though, is substantially less gentle. It all started when a student at NYU's business school walked into the class of Professor Scott Galloway a full hour after the lecture had started. Galloway stopped the lecture, and he asked the student to leave. The next day, the professor received an email. The student wanted to offer a little feedback about how the professor could improve his demeanor. So Professor Galloway wrote back, and the letter went viral online. So we asked our own Baz Luhrmann, producer Phil Harrell, to set Galloway's letter to music.
Thanks for the feedback. I, too, would like to offer some feedback. Get your together. There is a baseline level of decorum that we expect of tomorrow's business leaders. Getting a good job, working long hours, keeping your skills relevant, navigating the politics of an organization, finding a life-work balance. These are all really hard. In contrast, respecting institutions, having manners, demonstrating a level of humility, these are all relatively easy. Get the easy stuff right.
Get your together. Get the easy stuff right. Get your together. Get the easy stuff right.
In and of themselves, they will not make you successful. However, not possessing them will hold you back, and you will not achieve your potential, which you must have in spades. It's not too late. Again, thanks for the feedback.
The words of NYU Professor Scott Galloway in a letter to an unnamed student. It was read by our own Jim Howard, with vocals by Helena Johnson McNeely. The music's by the Golden Palominos. Our program was directed by Petra Mayer today. Their production staff includes Kate Davidson, Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Travis Larchuk, and Lauren Silverman. Our technical director is Sean Phillips. He's assisted by Paris Morgan, Cal Southworth, Mark Greenhouse, and John Widoff. Melissa Goh is the weekend web producer. Rick Holter is the senior editor. And our senior producer is Matt Martinez. And for Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.
From Toyota to Tiger Woods, newspapers are full of apologies these days. And in the Boston area, papers are also running a growing number of court-ordered mea culpas. For example, companies that plead guilty to polluting are being required to publish an apology as part of their punishment. NPR's Tobias Smith has more.
It's not on the front page like Tiger or Toyota, but if you flipped just a little deeper into several Boston area papers recently, you'd find an equally stark I'm sorry laid out in large font on a full page.
Our company has discharged human waste directly into coastal Massachusetts waters. That's bad. That's terrible.
At this coffee shop in Marblehead, 56-year-old Cindy Sisko reads the confession from the Rockmore Company, operator of a local ferry boat and restaurant. The ad says the company has paid a, quote, steep fine, but folks here seem more moved by the price the company's paying in reputation.
I think it's great, because they're going to learn their lesson. They're probably not going to put human waste in the ocean again.
That's 27-year-old hairdresser Danielle Yoakum.
I mean, that's disgusting. Do they have children that swim in the ocean? I mean, that's embarrassing, but people like this, of course. Put their name in there, give them a little bit of, you know, public humiliation. I don't feel bad.
You know, when something like this happens, other companies get the message.
That's former federal prosecutor Michael Sullivan, who's helped increase the use of these kinds of sanctions in Massachusetts, especially with companies who run afoul of environmental laws. Justice Department officials say the goal is deterrence. Sullivan says the high-profile mea culpas also tend to be more satisfying to a public increasingly frustrated with corporate wrongdoing.
I think that's what might frustrate the public when it doesn't appear that the company's been punished sufficiently enough by simply writing a check. It's simply the cost of doing business when you're caught.
Shaming sanctions have long been used against individuals, from shoplifters or drunk drivers confessing their crimes on sandwich boards to days way back in Puritan times.
Mistress, you must wear upon your bodice this symbol of your sinful fornication.
And from this day forward, you will be a pariah, cut off.
You would like to think that sentencing is evolving to move away from these types of public shamings. We got out of doing that for a reason.
Stelios Sinis is a federal public defender. He represented a Massachusetts fisherman who purposely sunk an old boat and had to run an ad saying that cutting corners was, quote, not worth it. The fisherman offered to go on a kind of speaking tour to make that point directly to other fishermen, but prosecutors insisted on the newspaper ad, leaving Sinis to question whether the goal was really more about a scarlet letter kind of retribution than deterrence.
When you impose a sentence that, you know, embarrasses the family members and creates hardship, you know, public humiliation and public ridicule and kind of ostracizes someone from the community, I think it's gratuitous. And that's just counterproductive to what you want to achieve.
Some offenders have appealed their sentences as cruel or unusual, but the courts have ruled that humiliation is within the bounds of fair punishment. Still, shaming sanctions continue to raise age-old questions about an eye-for-an-eye kind of justice.
Whether we call it vengeance, whether we call it psychic satisfaction, whether we call it restitution, we are getting to the core of what we as victims can rightfully claim to be entitled to.
Ohio State University law professor Doug Berman says judges must be careful when shaming individuals, but they don't have to worry the same way, he says, about scarring a company.
Right? Corporations don't feel. There are times when we do want to put the hurt on corporations, especially if it's a corporation who hurt the community.
When it comes to shaming corporations, Berman says, the real question is, does it work? And judges, he says, ought to be encouraged to try to find out. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
The people of Iceland have voted overwhelmingly against a plan to compensate the British and Dutch governments to the tune of about $5 billion. In a referendum held yesterday, more than 90% of people voted no. The vote followed a long campaign waged by the ordinary people of Iceland against having to pay the debts racked up by Iceland's bankers in the boom years. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Reykjavik.
Things have been fairly quiet in this corner of northwest Europe ever since the Vikings arrived here 1100 years ago and settled down. But that Viking spirit was rising again yesterday on the streets of Reykjavik. Letting off fireworks and letting off steam, a noisy demonstration took to the streets of the capital. Iceland's economy had one of the biggest booms as it moved from fish to banking. But now it's having one of the biggest busts.
We are not going to pay the debts for those bankers. Yeah, those guys have given their debts to us, the people of Iceland.
It's not fair that you and your children have to pay $10 million or something for some crazy people who are eating gold.
Svenbjörn Arnason and Grimur Gunnarsson tell the story that has passed into legend here that one of the best-known bankers ate flakes of pure gold sprinkled into a risotto. The bank causing most of the anger is Icesave, an internet bank that offered high interest rates and especially popular in Britain and the Netherlands. The British and Dutch governments compensated their angry savers when Icesave collapsed in 2008, but then billed Iceland. Reykjavik agreed to pay, but the Icelandic people objected to the terms of the payback, which led to yesterday's referendum. Egadur Svavarsson and Magnus Arni Skulason last night gathered around a television set with some friends. They're leaders in the fight against the terms of the repayment, and as the results came in last night, they were thrilled.
You are seeing here an outcome of 96.78% in all the districts voting no.
Democracy is a wonderful, powerful tool of expressing and putting a strong message that this is an unreasonable ISF agreement. We want a new agreement.
They say a renegotiated settlement will undoubtedly help Iceland recover faster from recession. The government says it is renegotiating the deal with the British and the Dutch. Others say the danger is the no vote could create another obstacle to economic recovery because the IMF will not release new funds to Iceland until the Icesave issue has been resolved, says Silja Bara Ómarsdóttir, a political scientist at the University of Iceland.
We're not getting the money from or through the IMF that we need to repay other debts and sort of keep ourselves afloat. And sometime during the next 18 months or so, we're really going to need to get money in order just to not go into a sovereign default.
In the meantime, the possibility of a worse credit rating and more difficulty in entering the European Union seem to be a price worth paying for the moral victory for the resurgent Viking spirit of the little guy. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Reykjavik.
You're listening to NPR News.